Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking with a remarkable mind a little later on the program about our global dysfunction and the need for the ethics of holism. Professor Glenn Martin, professor of philosophy and religious studies, will be here, and we're going to take on everything that's wrong at the ethical level. Also today, we're going to look at, has college become a danger to students? 8 ways science reveals that hugging creates a physiological response equivalent to drugs. Also, today marks an anniversary, one that I'll bet no one in this audience, or at least 99%, wouldn't know anything about. It happened on January 26, 1788. If you think you know what happened on January 6, 1788, that was really important, give a call, 888-874-4888. Dr. Gideon Paloa from Countercurrents will share some insights on that. From Health and Nutrition today, we're going to learn about artichokes that contain some really superpowers. Depression, unfortunately, causes cancer patients to die sooner. The additional healing power of Manuka honey. We're also going to look at a study showing beetroot juice again improves exercise function. And in consuming more fiber, quality fiber allows you to live longer, a substantial longer time, and cut your risk of death by 16%. So we have a lot to share. Let's get into everything right now. Well, I always start with health and nutrition. And the artichoke, well, it's something most Americans simply don't eat. It takes a little bit of time to prepare it. If not prepared correctly, it just becomes like a wet sponge. In and of itself, it has very little taste. It's very bland. But prepared correctly, as the Italians and the Spanish do, it's really tasty. But they generally soak it, they marinate it in oils and balsamic vinegar and seasonings. But if you were just to have some artichoke on a regular basis, this kind of thistle-like plant, which is common in North Africa and Europe, has some really strong healing benefits. It's been in use as a medicine since 4th century BC. The ancient Greeks and Romans both used it, mainly for digestive problems, but also we know it helps the liver. And here are some of the latest things uncovered by Cheryl Walters at Natural News. First and foremost, I don't know a holistic doctor that uses it, but they should, because it helps with irritable bowel, leaky gut syndrome, acid indigestion, nervous gastropathy, which is all of your itises, ileitis, colitis, spastic colon, Crohn's disease. So it's good for all that. Good for gallbladder problems. If you have elevated blood fats and promoting bile flow in the body, and that increases fat digestion, it also helps protect the intestinal mucosa from being hit by too much acid from the stomach. So artichokes are very good. They're non-toxic, very good to help lower your cholesterol, and that's important. So it's also very rich in a nutrient that is very powerful. I recommend it every day, quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N. Quercetin is an anti-cancer nutrient. It protects your skin. If you're bruising easy, it helps with that. If you have varicosities, it helps with that. If you have problems with your heart, it helps with that. It also is a good source of rutin, R-U-T-I-N. Now, rutin is a flavonoid, and that promotes the ability to protect against inflammation and allergies. It's a source of anthocyanins, A-N-T-H-O-C-Y-A-N-I-N-S. That helps lower the risk of cancer, improves urinary tract health, and it's good for your brain. Gallic acid, G-A-L-L-I-C, that we normally get in green tea, red tea, black tea, that helps protect the prostate from cancer. It also is a good source of antioxidants, caffeic acid, and chlorogenic acid. Those are strongly antimicrobial, anti-cancer, and antiviral. So people don't think of the simple little artichoke as anything that exotic, but it is. Now, one way you can start to eat it is I suggest you buy it in the jar and soaking in olive oil and seasonings, because it'll have a nice flavor and you can add it to salads. Then when you become a little more interested in it, then you can get the whole artichoke and prepare them for yourself. Last evening, we did the final filmed commentaries from people who had just completed the brain healing health study. We had a lot of people finish. All but one actually followed the protocols. The results were phenomenal. Now, I'm always now filming the beginning, the entry, and the ending so that you can see a person, hear a person say, here's what I have today. And then when they exit, say, I came with these conditions, here's what's changed. Now, these are not medical protocols. These are merely lifestyle and behavior protocols, improving the diet, but improving it in a way that is substantially different than anyone who's on a healthy diet. These people are not on a healthy diet. These people are on a super healing diet. And the trouble in the health field is that there are very few healthy people in the health field. In fact, I remember I just was lecturing this past week, and I did 8 lectures this past week. And one of them, I said that my very first event within the health movement was at the New York Coliseum. I was a very, very young fella, and I was invited simply because I had a best-selling book, bigger selling book than Adele Davis or Carlton Fredericks. I didn't know any of these people. I'd heard of them. And when I went backstage to wait my turn to lecture, I saw that all these people were extremely unhealthy. They were overweight. They were pasty looking. They smoked. They drank. None of them were into healthy lifestyle. There were a couple, but they weren't there. And Pavla Arola, Dr. Walker, were two very healthy and very nice people I would later meet in my travels on tour with different books. And Sheldon down in San Antonio, Texas, he was a healthy advocate. But I said, I don't want anything to do with this health movement. Today, most of the people in the health movement are simply not healthy. They're fattest. They have something they are making their money or their fame off of, and so that's where they spend all their time. So anyhow, the people in this health support group, if you just could imagine the amount of juices and nutrients that's going into their body, because you have to exceed the damage that's already there. If all you do is give people a good diet, you've done nothing, in my opinion, that will make a difference, because it's so subjective. Because it's much like, let me put it this way, make it a little easier to understand. We're terrified in our country, absolutely scared to death. Medical doctors, nurses, dietitians, of just looking at what's happening in the body and telling a person disease is a radical process. Your efforts to get well by having an orange or eating some sprouts or having some brown rice is like going over to a person that's just fallen off a 30-story building, hit the sidewalk, and you go over and say, I've got a Band-Aid for your nose. It just won't do it. You really have to compensate, and I call it the laws of compensation, to the degree that anything is either virally, bacterially, traumatically, or on any level, including genetically, predispose someone to a disease, you have to exceed the genetic expression. That means exceeding the vibration, the energy, and harmonize at a new level. Hence, you can literally change the genetic expression, and we have done it tens of thousands of times, reversing balding, thinning, and graying in people who have premature balding, graying, and thinning. And 1,500 people are just in one study group on that, which last year. So we've done it scientifically time and time and time again. So imagine last night, people get up, and they go in front of camera, uncoached, have no idea what they're going to say, and they look at the camera and they say, I had clinical depression, I was under medical supervision taking meds for the last 7 years, today I don't have any clinical depression, I'm taking meds, I've never felt better in my life. And you have one person say it, and another person say it, and another person say it, and another person say it. And a person says, I had multiple sclerosis advanced, now I have feeling in my foot, my leg is moving, I don't have the tremors. Another person, I have my memories back. Another person with Alzheimer's, I'm feeling so much better, I'm able to talk, I can carry on conversations where before I couldn't form words, I couldn't remember what I said. So that's the good news. And you'll be hearing that one day this week. I'll play about a 10-minute segment so you can get an idea of why these health support groups are so important for people. This is the latest. This is in the BBC. And this comes from Gillian Satin University in British Columbia. Quote, the University of British Columbia team said the finding emphasized the need to screen cancer patients carefully for signs of psychological distress. They looked at 9,400 patients. They published this in the peer-reviewed journal Cancer. They found death rates were 25% higher in patients showing symptoms of depression. Quote, cancer patients need not panic if they are experiencing depressive symptoms, but it is certainly reasonable to talk to their physicians about their mental health. End quote. Let's break this down and look at it from different perspectives. First, the fact that if you have cancer, you're more likely to have depression. That's been known for a long time. Secondly, there are over 5,000 articles in the peer-reviewed literature on psychoneuroimmunology showing that depression speeds up or creates multiple diseases or exacerbates diseases you have. So if you have heart disease and you're depressed, cancer and you're depressed, arthritis and you're depressed, I don't care what you have, and if you're depressed, it will become worse. The trouble is with cancer, you die sooner. 25% death rates increase. So that's a reality, and that's good to know that. Now, their solution is speak with your physician about your mental health. Well, what exact training does your physician have in compassion training, overcoming catastrophic disease training? None. Zero. Zip. So your physician's going to recommend you to a psychiatrist. Your psychiatrist is going to recommend an antidepressant medication. And the side effects are frequently, you guessed it, depression, suicidal thoughts, or suicide. So this is the blind side of the current medical model. Where do the two connect? Because could you imagine how many lives you could save if you look at how many cancer patients are depressed and you overcame that depression and saved 25%? Well, if you save 25% of all the people in the United States who are depressed with cancer, you're probably saving over 100,000 lives a year. Question, what proof do they have that they can overcome depression? Go to any university in the United States. Go to any psychiatric clinic, any mental health clinic. The results are zero. They haven't cured a single person. Not one. Not a single person. And yet they remain the only officially acceptable experts on what they have never been able to master. This is the phenomena that we live in. This is the Orwellian world. And yet, we just had 98% of the people who had depression in under 3 months, clinical depression, nothing, they couldn't get in unless they had a letter from their doctor, all right? And now they're happy, balanced. And yet what we did and we'll publish this in a journal. All the results will be turned over to an independent medical biostatistician who will write it up and get all the statistical analysis. It will probably end up being presented in the next year at some scientific conference, but it won't move anything. It won't change anything because the paradigm doesn't change unless it can control the change and profit from it. So just so you know, there are natural, non-toxic, lifestyle behavior, non-medical approaches to overcoming depression and anxiety disorder so debilitating that it has literally crippled people's lives. In under 3 months, they were able to reverse it. And before we take a break, one more good study on beet juice. This is from Wake Forest University. They studied the effects of the beet juice on exercise and lung capacity, and they found that it makes a difference, that it can enhance because of the nitrites, and I've mentioned this several times, improving circulation. In this case, it was with COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which makes it difficult for patients to breathe and worsens over time. And the patient then complained of shortness of breath with exertion, so tasks like climbing steps can leave them gasping for air. In turn, they tend to limit their activities, becoming more sedentary and lose fitness, and it becomes a negative cycle. So in this single-blind, placebo-controlled crossover study at the university's center there, they found that beet juice made a difference. So that's good. So if you have COPD, or if you're just going out for exercise, take, I would say, 6 ounces, that's a small amount, 6 ounces of beetgrass juice, and then add 6 ounces of coconut water. And the two together are really good. Now, for those of you who've been drinking grape juice, as I recommend, or taking grapes, which is also great, or taking grape concentrate, which is good. Grape concentrate is just where they take the grape juice and they evaporate a lot of the water, so you're getting more of the actual healing nutrients. And just to give you an idea, 2 ounces of grape juice concentrate has more resveratrol in it than a case of red wine. So look at getting the benefits from the more concentrated forms, and then the grape powder is your most single concentrated source. Here's the latest from Psychology Today. Quote, talks about looking at over 2,000 scientific papers. Quote, this is from Psychology Today. When I wrote my first blog on research on resveratrol benefits for brain function and memory, there were over 2,000 scientific papers. Resveratrol is an active ingredient in red wine. Some people think that resveratrol explains why French people who drink a lot of red wine are healthier than predicted by their lifestyle of little exercise and eating lots of cheese. But most studies suggest you would have to drink 100 or more glasses of red wine a day to get much resveratrol effect. By the way, he is correct on that. And then you'd end up with toxic alcohol. And they're talking about more concentrated forms. Most of the protective biological actions associated with resveratrol have been associated with its scavenger properties of free radicals and protective effects it confers on the heart and diabetes. One important study comes from a diabetes research group in Brazil, recently reported the benefits of resveratrol and had amazing benefits. And then it talks about how it also protects your brain. And then it goes on and talks about why it's one of the most important nutrients there is out there. I would agree with this. And so I just want people to make sure that you're eating organic grapes. Not the green ones. Green ones won't have it, but the red ones, the black ones, the blue ones do. Or drinking, there's some organic Concord grape juice that's very good. You can use that. But get your resveratrol each day. And finally, Gamma-tocopherol, which is vitamin E, enhances the effects of colorectal cancer cell destruction. This is from the researchers from the School of Pharmacy, reports daily of new studies and findings in the area of colon cancer. And this was from Clinical Oncology Week and talked about how they had really good benefits with gamma-tocopherol. So, vitamin E, one more reason to take it for your colon. Oh, and by the way, for those of you who want to regenerate a damaged brain, let's say you've had a stroke or Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, turmeric. Turmeric, as we know, is one of the most important herbs in the world. It's a spice. And in that spice is an active ingredient, curcumin. And turmeric can contribute to regeneration of a, quote, damaged brain and to help with neurological disorders. This is published in Stem Cell Research and Therapy, a major scientific journal. Quote, the recent study both showcases yet another benefit of turmeric while providing evidence that the magic compound curcumin within turmeric isn't the only compound responsible for the spice's healthy benefit. Researchers noted that a lesser-known fat-soluble component within turmeric, known as AR-turmerone, may make, quote, a promising candidate to support regeneration in neurological disease. Scientists discovered that when they put neural stem cells in petri dishes and bathe them in extracts of AR-turmerone, up to 80% more of the stem cells grew into neurons or other cells. This is compared to control experiments where the chemical was not used. What's more, upon injecting the turmeric extract into a part of the brain where these cells are located, similar increased growth and proliferation of stem cell into neurons was detected. Study co-author Dr. Adele Ruger, a researcher at University Hospital of Cologne, Germany, and the Institute of Neuroscience and Medicine, says that the aromatic AR, that's what aromatic stands for, turmerone, is a major bioactive component of the herb curcuma longo. It has been suggested that it inhibits the activation of property that may be useful in treating neurodegenerative disease. So, for all the people, and we're talking about tens of millions in the United States who need better nutrition for their brain, this is a superstar. One more reason to use it. You want to live longer life? You want to cut the risk of death by 16%? According to Shanghai Cancer Institute in China, they looked at 17 studies tracking 982,411 men and women, and they found that those that had the highest amounts of fiber had the lowest death rates. This was published in the American Journal of Epidemiology. And so my suggestion is 35 to 50 grams of quality fiber a day, including fibers from fruits. Your best fruit fiber would be like pomegranate, blueberries, cherries, strawberries. And then your grains, whole grains, like amaranth is great. Brown rice fibers are great. Oats are great. And in fact, oats are right at the top of the list because of oat beta-glucan. And then beans are good. So get a wide variety all the time, every day. All right, it helps you and cuts your risk of death based upon all those studies that they just talked about. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Love me. You are my shining star, my guiding light, my love. There's not a minute, hour, day, or night that I don't love you. You're at the top of my list, cause I'm always thinking of you. I still remember in the days when I was scared to touch you, how I spent my day dreaming, planning how to say I love you. You must have known that I had feelings deep enough to swim in. That's when you opened up your heart and you told me to come in.
Welcome all of you from all over the United States to different cities listening, as well as around the world. Coming up in about 10 minutes, we're going to talk for the rest of the show about our global dysfunction and the need for an ethics of holism with Professor Glenn Martin. He is a part of our ongoing series on conversations with remarkable minds. He's professor of philosophy and religious studies at Radford University in Virginia, and founder of its program in peace studies. Also, I realize a lot of you, like right now, you have no idea the numbers. They are astronomical, are listening over the telephone because you travel. Right now, you might be in an airport stuck by a storm. You dial a number, you can listen to the program. That number, so you all have it, write it down. You never know when you're going to be someplace and need it. 712-432-7231, 712-432-7231, and that way you can listen in. Also, I want to say thank you to all of you who are going to the Facebook page and sharing information, and it's quite a lot of people. Just this morning, we had some astronomical numbers up there, and so 22,765,123 on our Facebook reached. So, not bad. People are watching articles, movies, reading articles, and sharing calls to action. And I want to share something with you now from Dr. Gideon Paleo from Countercurrents. This is about the British. No one called in, so I'm assuming people weren't aware of it. I was watching something that Tony Blair said, and how that his country only wanted peace when he was prime minister, and yet he worked with George Bush to get it into the Iraq war. Had he said no, then there's likelihood that Bush wouldn't have gone alone. Then you have the current David Cameron, who again talks about Britain being, you know, a country of peace. Since when? How many countries do you think the British have invaded? Let's start with 193 countries. That's correct. In the last two millennia, the British have invaded 193 out of 203 present-day countries. Now, there's 195 UN-recognized countries and 8 non-UN-recognized self-governing countries as compared to the French that have 80 and the U.S. has 70. So we've invaded 70 countries, the French 80, Israel 12. However, the British invasion of Australia on January 26, 1788, ultimately destroyed as many as 600 unique indigenous Australian tribes and a comparable number of languages and dialects. That is substantial. It is estimated that in 1788 there were 300 distinct Aboriginal language groups and 750 dialects, of which only 150 survive. This is making the Australian Aboriginal genocide qualitatively one of the worst genocides in human history. And today is being commemorated as Invasion Day by the Indigenous Australians, and it's celebrated as Australian Day by white Australians as the day when white Australia began. Well, in 2015, the British, having invaded all but 10 out of the world's 203 countries, are still invading other countries. Indeed, Great Britain is currently invading Syria, and they've been in Iraq. And these appalling statistics make a compelling case for the whole British devastated world And so they celebrate it. Isn't it interesting how people will say, well, this is when our country started, and other people say this is when our country and its languages and tribe ended. Before the British invasion of Australia in 1788 on this day, Indigenous Australians had been living in Australia for over 60,000 years. There were about 750 different tribes, 300 different groups, as I mentioned, 750 dialects, of which only a tiny fraction survive. After the British invasion, the Aboriginal population dropped from about 1 million to 10,000 in the first century through introduction of disease, dispossession, deprivation, and genocidal violence. The last massacres Aborigines recorded occurred in the 1920s, but no treaty was ever signed. Indigenous Australians were only counted after a referendum in 1967 and were finally given some protection by the 1975 Radical Discrimination Act. In the 20th century, up to 1 in 10 Aboriginal children were forcibly removed from their mothers. This is what is called the Stolen Generation. They were forcibly removed of Aboriginal children from their mothers is continuing today at a record rate, still going on today. Indigenous Australians are far worse off than white Australians in relation to housing, health, wealth, social conditions, imprisonment, deaths in custody, forcible removal of children, avoidable death, and life expectancy. In many respects, you could consider the Aborigines the Palestinians of Australia and the Australian people are indifferent, ignorant, or complicit. Article 2 of the UN Genocide Convention states, quote, in the present convention, genocide means any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy, in part or whole, a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group, such as killing members of the group, causing serious bodily or mentally harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. Ah, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. Well, that is exactly what Australians have been doing today and historically, and shame on Australia and the people who have committed this or supported it, because what you have not had in Australia, you have not had a mass outpouring of the average person to challenge this genocide. Then again, you never had it in the United States to challenge the genocide of Native Americans. And then again, you never had it in the United States where most of the whites challenged slavery. Racism is what it is. In 2000 alone, 9,000 Aborigines out of an original population of 500,000 died avoidably every year. That's a very high percentage because of conditions. And there are a lot of books written about this. All the countries we've ever invaded and a few we never got around to. Stuart Laycock's book covered the 193 UN member states plus the Vatican and Kosovo and concluded that the British had invaded all but 22. However, his list was not conclusive because there were 10 that there were invasions or efforts by other people which they supported. And then I have a list of all the countries that Britain invaded over the history, and yet there has been no apology by anyone in a leadership position that they are a genocidal nation run by psychopaths, including the top of the top. The British notoriously conquered Palestine after in World War I and then enabled the Zionist colonizers to ultimately take over all of the former mandatory Palestine, and indeed ethically cleansed 90% of the Palestinians of its indigenous Palestinian inhabitants, something that Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly seem ignorant. And Bill says he's a history teacher. What history does he focus on? Certainly not the truth of indigenous Palestinian inhabitants. The British have technically also invaded Taiwan. They shelled it in World War II. Kosovo, technically part of Serbia that was bombed by the British and in the Balkans War, and so all these other countries. the list of countries that have not actually seen British national or mercenary forces being invaded are just 10. That's it. Now, we're far behind them. We're at 70. France has invaded more than we have, 80. So the consequence of the British invasion was typically genocide of indigenous people, explained by the Australian Aboriginal genocides and American Indian genocides through violence, dispossession, introduction of disease. However, in India and China, while there were just too many indigenous inhabitants for total extermination, indigenous deaths were enormous. Thus, 20 to 100 million Chinese died in the 19th century. The Taiping Rebellion, precipitated by British imperialism and the Opium Wars, and the Indian avoidable deaths from imposed deprivation totaled 1.8 billion. You heard me right. Let me pronounce that again. State that again. 1.8 billion over two centuries, over 200 years, were killed by the British or caused the death of because of British rule. In African slavery, disposition, exploitation, dislocation, relocation killed scores of millions, and the impact of the colonies worldwide continues under neo-colonial hegemony. Thus, annual avoidable deaths as a percentage of population is very high. From 1950 to 2005, avoidable deaths from deprivation in countries occupied by Britain in the post-1945 era totaled 727 million, as compared to 147 million by the French, 82 million by the U.S. and occupied, 24 million apartheid Israel, with the breakdown, and then it goes into in substantial detail of how these occurred. Conclusions. The British have invaded 193 countries out of a total of 203 countries that are UN recognized. The consequences of British invasion for greed-based conquest are substantial. Indigenous people in America and Australia, Africa, have been put into mass murder categories. Scores of millions of Africans and Chinese in avoidable deaths from privations under British rule. History ignored is history repeated. Britain today is still invading, still devastating other countries, Mali, Libya, Iraq, Afghanistan, and in the Zionist-promoted U.S. war on Muslims. Not satisfied with Britain's first Syrian war, World War I, and Britain's second Syrian war, World War II, the U.K. is now presently engaged in Britain's third Syrian war. Similarly, not satisfied with Iraq's invasion from 1914 to 1932, and its second one, 1941-48, Britain's third Iraq war, 1990 to 2003, with sanctions in which 1.7 million Iraqis, half of them children, died avoidably from imposed deprivation. And that's where most of these people end up dying. So where the Australians celebrate today, there's a whole lot of people who wouldn't. I'm Gary Knoll. Let us now go to our my guest who is standing by. And I've given you his background a little earlier, Professor Glenn Martin. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
You, by the way, you have been involved or are involved in the peace organizations in different countries, Costa Rica, Greece, India, and elsewhere, and recently became president of the World Constitution and Parliament Association that is making efforts to create a non-military democratic world under the Constitution for the Federation of Earth Manifesto. By the way, he has also written numerous articles and books, including Triumph of Civilization, Democracy, Nonviolence, and the Piloting of Spaceship Earth, and the Earth Federation Movement. And his latest book is The Anatomy of a Sustainable World, Our Choice Between Climate Change and Systems Change. His website is radford.edu/gmartin. What do you think about Greece today, finally, being able to have a populist movement in place and immediately being threatened by the European Union that you owe us this money, you're going to have to pay us all this money, we're not giving you any breaks, and the world being angry, the major media being angry that these people, meaning the Greek citizens, actually took back some power from the Triarcha.
Well, I think it's a very exciting thing that the people of Greece have risen up and said that this is enough. We're sick of this capitalist-imposed austerity program, which is something, as you know, that's going on worldwide. And that's why we struggle for a world transformation, because it's a world problem. It's a systemic problem of the world. That's what we're talking about when we say that we need a democratic constitution for the Federation of Earth.
It's a completely original thought. I witness a sharp division within the progressive movement today. And by a progressive movement, I would include all the many groups and organizations and individuals who are anti-war, environmentalists working against climate change, and struggling for racial and economic justice, and who adamantly oppose the duopoly in Washington's politics and American imperialism. On the one hand, there are those who believe we can make incremental changes in the existing system of governance. That's your corporate Democrats. That's MSNBC. That's The Nation. That's so many publications. I read their articles, and I'm saddened by their lack of insight, because they think, well, we'll just reform this law. We'll get a reformer in there instead of transformer. And on the other hand, there's a smaller contingency who believe we are well beyond the threshold of struggling for small quantitative changes, and the entire system of global governance and corporate free market capitalism needs to be overhauled and replaced outright with what might be called a more integral view of the world and the problems we face. And all of our wars and conflicts today can technically be reduced to the bare elements of national competition and conflicts over resources, and resources that are only absolutely necessary for an unsustainable system and for a failing system of economics and political governance. However, for the average person, particularly in the United States, they are unable to connect all the many dots that point directly towards a system that is totally, intrinsically self-destructive and is now threatening the lives of billions of people. So take your time and please juxtapose these two worldviews, the fragmented view that believes incremental changes can save us from catastrophe, and then the holistic view that realizes that not only when the entire system is recognized as faulty, can real change then begin?
Yes, I think you lay out the alternatives very nicely. And that's why I don't, as much as I admire the people of Greece, I don't think it's going to make much difference in the ultimate scheme of things. The world system that we, as we encounter it, and I was listening just a few minutes ago to your account of the of British imperialism around the world. It is truly frightening, you know, and that the British were the global hegemon prior to the power being centered primarily in the United States, and today it's in the United States, which is the global hegemon. And what this world system is an integral conjunction of global capitalism, global corporate capitalism, with the power of the imperial nation states. In the case of the United States, it has its allies in Britain and some of the European states, and the system is pervasive. It's globalized. It's been globalized for at least a century now, but of course, with this new concept of globalization, the propaganda system tells us that, oh, there's something inevitable, that we've got to have this free market in the world system, and they tell people that you can make a difference in politics within the United States or politics within Greece or a struggle in Venezuela to for the people to take back their government. But it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen unless we human beings, and this is where I liked your phrase holism that you used a moment ago, Gary. It's not going to happen unless we human beings who realize that we're all the same on this planet, we all have the same fundamental needs, we all need to act with reason and compassion and create a decent world order. That's when it's going to happen. We have to decide that the 5% who now own more than 50% of the global wealth are not going to ruin our planet and ruin our lives. And that's why we work for non-military democratic world government, because the only force, the only authority, legitimate authority that could possibly transform the world would be a government that's over the nation states, that can, by law, systematically disarm them, and a government that is over the global transnational corporations that can, by law, require them to act sustainably and for the common good.
I appreciate those insights. Let's go one step further in what you're speaking about, because many listeners will not have heard of the Earth Constitution, which advocates the need to think globally about our planet's challenges and threats. Would you please speak more about that? And then, as a philosopher and scholar in religious studies, how can a person make the qualitative leap in a mindset from a fragmented worldview to a global holistic view?
It's true that many people have not heard of the Earth Constitution, although it is rapidly becoming known throughout the world. But this movement goes, it isn't new. The movement goes back to the First World War. Some of the leaders of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom that was founded in 1915 were decrying the First World War as a war of sovereign militarized nation states recognizing no effective law above themselves, just struggling for power in the world. And that was, as far as a movement is concerned, that was the beginning of the World Federalist Movement, where people began to say, we need democratic world government. We need a law over these nations that can give us a decent world for everybody. The Constitution of the for the Federation of Earth came out of this groundswell of activism that was there very actively between the two world wars, and then came to a culmination after the Second World War. There were many, many people who were world federalists. Albert Einstein was one. Emory Reeves, a number of serious thinkers were said. Albert Camus, in his famous essay, Neither Victims Nor Executioners, they were all saying we need a world parliament over everybody. The founders of the Earth Constitution organized beginning in 1958, and worked worldwide to bring hundreds of world citizens together, international lawyers, academics, thinkers, and they met beginning in 1968 in four constituent assemblies in various cities around the world and worked together to write this constitution. It was finally finished in 1991 in a big meeting in Troia, Portugal, and since 1991, our organization, the World Constitution and Parliament Association, has offered this constitution to the world as an alternative that can transform our world system and give us a real future on this planet. How can people, now your second question, how can people spiritually make this kind of transition? I think that it is happening all over the world. A number of psychologists, a number of visionary thinkers and progressive thinkers have been talking about human beings going through stages of consciousness where our consciousness transmutes. It becomes more and more mature, more and more universal, more and more compassionate. Carol Gilligan, for example, in her book, In a Different Voice, talks about a stage of maturity that she calls universalistic, and then a higher stage which she calls integral. Right? People are beginning to realize worldwide that we need to begin thinking holistically and thinking as one species on this planet, one set of human beings who all have the same needs and have a finite, fragile planet that we have to preserve and save for ourselves and for future generations. I would like to suggest that spiritually, this is in the air. And in our organization, the World Constitution and Parliament Association, which has chapters in many countries, we have people who are Muslims who think that this is what the Quran was ultimately talking about, a decent world of peace and respect and diversity for everyone. We have people who are Christians who think that this is a preliminary to bringing the kingdom of God on earth, which was the message of Jesus. And we have people who are atheists who say this holism is scientifically proven, which it is. The holism of the earth is a planet, the holism of human beings, and we can move from that holism to create a new world system that serves everybody in the future generations.
I'd like to ask you something as a philosopher now, all right? I watched a movie the other night called American Sniper, and it was disturbing because I saw how everyone in the audience packed was cheering this person on, and I heard their comments as we were leaving the theater. It portrays a very disturbing and dysfunctional code of ethics built upon the values of hatred towards the other. No questioning that. Questioning whether the other deserves to die, why we were in their land, were there any justifying factors? What would happen, for example, if you heard that the Russians or Chinese or someone had invaded Texas? Do you think that people would rebel? Do you think they would become insurgents against this invasion? No discussion whatsoever. It was just black and white. To me, these are perverted values, and they're not uncommon among many Americans, particularly the radical extremes of Christianity and Zionism and the majority of the Republican Party. And they're the values of American exceptionalism, which I deplore, and the imperialist domination. These are individuals and groups who only believe in scientific facts that confirm their pet beliefs that are fundamentally selfish, tribal, and exclude all who disagree with them. And it's an epidemic in climate change denialism. On the other hand, science and what is now emerging as a new metaphysics confirms what you just mentioned, that human survival relies upon harmony rather than conflict and discord. And genetics proves that all people are interconnected. Evolutionary biology has now shown that our species evolves not through survival of the fittest, that is a myth, but through survival through cooperation. Now, these contribute to what you have called an ethics of holism. So please speak further on this new ethical code based upon science and metaphysical observation of the world and ourselves, and what it is it, and why it's critical that more and more people embrace holistic ethical values.
I've got a book that's going to be out in the spring that's going to be about holism. And it's called Renaissance, the New Philosophical Holism and Our Global Social Contract. In that book, I look at the literature, starting with the scientific literature. And as I think you're pointing out correctly, beginning in 1905 with Einstein's special theory of relativity, the cosmologists have begun to realize that the universe itself is an integral whole. And then with the development of quantum physics they have discovered this holism at the tiniest microparticle level, that there's no such thing as building blocks of the universe, that everything is interconnected in a dynamic unities. And then in anthropology, as you're pointing out, they have discovered scientifically that every human being is genetically almost identical with every other human being, and that all these differences that fragment us, national differences, cultural differences, racial differences, and so on, they're really just insignificant, completely insignificant as far as our unity as human beings is concerned. And then, of course, finally, and again, scientifically corroborated at great length, has been the discovery of the unity of the planetary biosphere. The fact that on this finite planet, all the forces that operate, from the sunlight coming in to the oceans to the air to the ecosystems to the living things, all these elements of our biosphere are delicately woven into a holism, an ecological holism that we are rapidly destroying, and with our capitalism and our refusal to understand this, to convert to a holistic point of view, and so on. So I think that's very, very much this kind of transformation of our consciousness.
We're out of time for now, unfortunately.
But
we look forward to reading The Anatomy of a Sustainable World, Our Choice Between Climate Change and Systems Change, and also your new upcoming book on holism and holism models of existence, coexistence. Thank you very much for all your great work, Professor Glenn Martin, Professor of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Radford University in Virginia. Appreciate you being with us.
Okay. Thank you very much.
We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Well, one thing I wanted to mention was a number of your listeners, about half a dozen of them, emailed me about that movie that you mentioned, The American Sniper, and they suggested that the liberals are attacking the movie left and right, and they're asking about your opinion. And you did mention a little bit, but if you wanted to elaborate a little bit more, it might help.
All right, I'll just make it quick, and I'll do more of a commentary. What you have in the movie from the very beginning is you have one person's perspective on honoring his sense of patriotism. The problem is it's an extremely limited view, and one that distorts the way that human beings should relate. It was also a person who was not a deep thinker, as many people are not, does not look at the consequences of their action upon others, but rather looks at the consequence of the action or inaction if they did not honor who they believe they are. So if a person believes they are a patriot and would die for their country, they're not going to ask whether the country is right or wrong. They're simply going to say, you show me the enemy, and I will go out there and risk my life to kill that enemy. And that's what the movie's about. It's all about a man, how he copes with his celebrity status. Everywhere in the movie, he's being called this unique person, this superhero. But when he goes home after four tours of duty in Afghanistan, he is suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. He can't function. And that's how the movie leaves it, that he cannot function, that it took a toll on him. Now, the people on the left and the progressive and liberal and the humanistic and spiritual community will find the movie disheartening, and I'll do a more in-depth commentary on it tomorrow because we're running out of time. But on the other hand, picture yourself as being an average person, a person who's not one of the 1%, but a person who needs a hero, needs something to believe in, needs to know that there is someone doing something unique and special. They will find this man their hero because he was willing to die for what he believed in. So if you're not able to challenge the bank that you borrowed a credit card, got a credit card from, or got your house through and your mortgage was underwater and you lost it, and if you're not able to understand why you are now going to be paying your money out of your retirement, your Social Security for your kid who cannot find a job, college loan you signed on, if you can't understand why you have all these diseases and you can't afford to heal them, the system keeps finding ways of excluding you. If you find that you can't walk down your streets at night safely, if you find you've been pulled over and your assets confiscated under asset forfeiture by the police, and yet a wealthy person driving a limousine, a Rolls Royce, wouldn't have their car pulled over. When you find that you're being stopped and searched and asked to empty your pockets because of your ethnicity, and yet you know no one else in the white neighborhoods are, white affluent neighborhoods, then you're going to look around to see if there's any way that you can attach to someone who is doing something that pushes back. And now, as warped as it may seem, when they attach a hero status to someone who had all these kills, officially 160, or unofficially over 250 kills, and who seems to get the bad guy, then that's a smackdown against authority. It's a warped concept, but that's why so many people are rushing out to see the film. It's well done in what it says, but it's extremely a one-sided perspective. It does not honor the people who are killed, doesn't honor. It makes it seem as if every Iraqi, no matter what their age, if they were 4 years old, because the first person he kills in the movie is a young four-year-old boy, that they're monsters and they deserve to be killed. So if you exclude all other considerations from your reality, then your reality is going to be extremely distorted. But this is not a film to go into to think about what it means to be the occupied force, what it means to be the deprived force, what it means to have already had 400,000 children die of sanctions, what it means to be living in depleted uranium, what it means to have no rights, what it means to have ethnic violence between Sunni and Shia, which we caused. None of those questions are raised, and therefore it's just a typical John Wayne film. This guy, John Wayne, is going to kill the Indians, hooray for him, or die at the Battle of the Alamo, hooray for his courage. It does not ask any of the nuanced and deeper questions. That's why so many people are running out to see this film. Hope that answers your question. I'll do a more in-depth commentary on American Sniper on tomorrow's program.
Thank you.
Okay, let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. On this day of a wonderful winter storm, we're talking about America's race and power conundrum. Is there any way out?
Race in America?
Race and power.
We have a problem with race and power in America?
I don't think so, but there are people who say that might be the case.
Okay, well, gee, this is a surprise to me. I got to listen now. Utrice Lead calling to us from under the ground. She is hiding under a cypress tree somewhere in Florida.
Back better hanging under than from.
Just like you do.